Well, you tip out another thriller here. Last time we chatted, we did a lot of talking about your history and your childhood, your voiceovers, and your theater work, and how you went away from home. Today, I thought I'd like to ask you some more literary questions. One of the things that interested me was that in the Bourne Identity, that was our first introduction to David Webb.
Yeah, about 6 years ago, yeah.
And he became Jason Bourne in there. I wanted to ask you about the origins of that book, and, well, tell me a little bit about that book and what happened to David Webb in that book, and how that book left off.
You mean in the Bourne Identity?
Yes, to begin with.
Yeah, well, the Bourne Identity came out of two germs of thought. One was the fact that this is going to sound like a real what do you call it, non sequitur to you, but Pierre Salinger, if you remember, had written an introduction to the French edition of a book of mine called The Chancellor Manuscript, and it was a lovely thing. And my French being as bad as it is, I had to have Berlitz translated completely, but I understood enough of it even by myself. And one night, my wife said to me, you know, Pierre Salinger is broadcasting from Vienna. It was sort of like a silent thank you. We turned it on, although I had no idea what he was going to talk about. And he talked about the fact that Carlos the Jackal, the supreme assassin, as it were, had been spotted in Vienna and had gotten away. Now, that started me thinking. I knew about Carlos the Jackal, but not that much. So I began doing some research. 3 days after that, I was sitting at home having coffee, and I got a call from my accountant in New York saying, we're living in Connecticut, and he said, all right, I expect you at 11 o'clock. I said, what do you mean you expect me at 11 o'clock? Where? He said, in New York. I said, you never told me that. He said, well, I was up at your house yesterday, and we were talking about it. What had happened to me, and there is a medical thing about this, a medical term. I had lost about 12 hours of my life. I had not been drinking. It wasn't a question of alcohol or anything like that. But either the stresses of having just finished a book or something had led me just to forget, like 12 hours. And there is a medical term for it. It's a temporary amnesia. And I had promised Mary that I would not sit down and start another book for at least a couple of weeks. But the idea of that kind of incredible news that Pierre Salinger related about Carlos the Jackal having been seen in Vienna and having done some reading about that, and then the fact that I had lost 12 hours of my life when I was supposed to be in New York and I didn't remember that the guy had even been up in my house, I put the two germs of thought together and thought, supposing the man was after Carlos the Jackal and lost his memory by going into deep cover. That was the genesis of the Bourne Identity. Now we shift years later. I've heard time and time again since I wrote that book, what about a sequel? Well, there never could be a sequel because until within the last week, by the way, Carlos the Jackal is still alive and still doing this obscene thing. And I would never write a sequel where Carlos the Jackal got away again, as it were, because then I'd be giving a kind of a mythological legend to a very dirty man whose best exit from this world should be swift, and I would never want to be accused of that. But I got so drawn to the Sino-British negotiations over the Hong Kong Accords that my wife and I flew over to Hong Kong, to Macau, up the Deep Bay waterways, up into Shenzhen and Beijing and what have you. And I said, my God, there's a story here. There's a wonderful thing that is happening in the Far East. Wonderful, and yet with a few miscalculations could be total chaos. Then I began to think, now I've got to find a protagonist, be it a he or a she, whatever. And I was racking my brains, and I thought to myself, gee, you can't throw a Western innocent into the Oriental chaos without hundreds and hundreds of pages of exposition and explanation. Read that as being shot for turning in a 3,000-page manuscript. And I found some notes that I had written 6 years ago about Bourne Identity in my office. And I thought, my Lord, there's my man. He was an Oriental scholar. He was a Foreign Service officer in Phnom Penh. He knows half a dozen Oriental languages, perhaps three dozen dialects. That's my man. And then the more I thought about it, the more I thought, at the end of Born Identity, there was a very interesting character, at least interesting to me, which the lady who became his wife, and I knew she'd have to make a very major contribution. So in a sense, I did not seek the sequel. The sequel evolved from, or evolved to me, and that's why it's a sequel. There you are.
In effect, you have a character with a dual personality.
Absolutely, yes. And I had never really explored who that man really was before. Because somehow I've thought many times that sequels are sort of a cop-out in characterization. You're not inventing something new, you're going over retreads. But in this case, it wasn't a question of that, because the last line of The Born Identity is, "My name is David." And I had never explored who David Webb was, who had become Jason Bourne to go after the Jackal. So it was kind of a whole new thing for me, and I enjoyed doing it.
In a way, for a writer of thrillers, you're unusual, because outside of The Bourne Identity and The Bourne Supremacy, you have never created a serious hero.
No.
Why?
No. Because, I, as I just said, I think in many ways it's a cop-out. You know the person. I like to go fresh to a character and invent someone new. In this case, I had that opportunity because although I'd written about this man in a previous book, one never knew him because he had amnesia. Mm-hmm. He had total amnesia. He did not know why he was, where he was, or who he was. And in that book, it was only at the end that he saw flashes of his previous life. But he couldn't understand the fact that as I recall, in Born Identity, that somebody would throw lines at him. He didn't know why he knew Oriental languages. He didn't know that he was a doctorate in Oriental studies. He had no idea. Now I could have a chance to explore that other person in this book.
And yet, interestingly, at the end of The Born Supremacy, Dr. Penoff, the psychiatrist, says, Jason Bourne is gone forever.
Oh, yeah.
And yet, I feel there's something almost tentative about that that might leave the door open for David Webb to come back as Jason Bourne.
You know, the funny thing is that I didn't mean it to be tentative. Maybe something, you know, consciously with me put it that way, but I think he's finished.
Assertion, though, you haven't put David Webb to rest.
I guess not.
No.
But I hadn't thought of it that way. I have no plans that I can think of now to bring back Jason Bourne. I'm working on something else totally away from anything like that. But, you know, it's that old thing, never say never.
Interestingly, Elmore Leonard, I don't know if you've read any of his
books.
Yes,
of course.
He's a very good writer.
Yes, he is.
But almost all of his books have the same character.
Yeah.
They have different names and different heights and weights and mustaches.
Yeah.
But
he
has made changes in the name, he was telling me, because for various reasons. Some are contractual, for example. He had sold the movie rights for a book that was to use this character's name, and he had problems with putting him into another book with the same name, so all he did was change the name.
Yeah.
But he keeps using the same character over and over again.
Well, he's a terribly good writer, and he can do that, because he is such a good writer. I do not have the confidence in myself to do that. I have to change characters completely. I think that I might, you know, just not come off as well as perhaps I might if I work with a serious character.
It was interesting. Also, you have some very good descriptions of Hong Kong and the East. I was going to ask you, and I guess you, in effect, already answered it. You have traveled a lot over there, haven't you?
Oh, yes, of course. You know, as a matter of fact, when I first got interested in the Sino-British negotiations, the thing so gripped me, so grabbed me, because it was a part of the world that I knew, you know, long before you were born, my friend. I was in the Marines and was over there briefly. You know, for like 2 weeks. And I wanted to go back. I wanted to see. And as I say, when we went there, there were so many contradictory opinions from so many people, all stridently stated, with a sad note of, We accept the fact there may be eruptions of violence, chaos, but we will survive because we are survivors. And that led to me to believe that God, what a story. And so the more I traveled, the more I was convinced of this. It's a fascinating area of the world.
But the physical descriptions as well. When you travel like that, do you keep notes for yourself?
Oh, yeah, I keep notes. As my younger son says, I take volumes of terrible photographs. But they help me.
That's a wonderful way to remember things.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
Because I know in my own childhood, there are lots of holes in my childhood, but there are photographs that sometimes I don't even have possession of. They're at my family's home in Texas, but when I go to visit, I get these old photographs out of myself in the 30s and early 40s, and they just they bring things to mind so vividly.
And of course, when you're traveling so rapidly, and your childhood was not rapid any more than mine was, that fills in holes. Or let's say it fills in gaps, I think we would both agree, with both of us in terms of photographs from our childhood. When you're traveling rapidly, trying to research, these fill in the minute holes, the little lapses that you'll forget. A street, a shop, a section of the Hong Kong waterfront, one that's known as a go-down, which you know is for drug traffic and this and that and this and that. You take photographs of this, and it fills in and gives you all kinds of words just by looking at it.
And you can have all the neighbors in to watch them.
I do my best not to do that. No, I'd get arrested. No.
Now, I wanted to ask you a couple other things. The various elements in thriller writing, and of course there's no better thriller writer in the country than you are.
Thank you.
To sit down to read a genre book the type that you write, there must be certain elements in it. Now, I don't know if you consciously conceive of these various elements, but I just wonder if you can kind of be philosophical about it and tell me the things that you believe are necessary in creating a thriller, the type that you write.
I think perhaps... And you're asking me philosophically, because I do not sit down with a formula. I just don't do that. I've heard that I do, and I wish somebody would tell me what it is, because I don't know what it is. I don't sit down and say I'm even going to write a thriller, much less anything that's popular. I don't do that. But I think, philosophically, I come from the theater. And I think that perhaps pace, interest in the next act, or turning a page, and character, which is all part of the theater. In other words, if a person at the end of Act 1 is going to leave the theater and not come back for Act 2, then subsequently for Act 3 is not going to come back for the ending, you're on the unemployment line on Monday morning. And I've been in many a Broadway show as an actor, and my unemployment number was 1344. I'll never forget it. So I learned a few things from the theater. And I think that's probably, philosophically, what I think is terribly important is... One, a theme, two characters, in that order, three plot, and four pace, so that you don't lose the interest of the audience. That's what the theater taught me.
Looking a little closer at theme, what about global theme? Because it would seem to me that somebody who writes even a mystery novel that focuses on a small event, or a relationship with a mother, or his father, or a family.
No, I'm talking a larger thing. I'm talking geopolitically, really.
Yeah,
in a sense.
Because most of your books have to do with catastrophe or impending.
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah, because again, it's the melodrama of the theater, as George Bernard Shaw once said, or words to the effect: if you want to get your points across, leave them shocked or leave them laughing, but for heaven's sakes, leave them with a desire to come back for your next bill of fare. And Mr. Shaw made his points in a far more intellectual and far more refined way than I ever would be capable of. But I've never forgotten that advice that he wrote in one of his footnotes. I think it was a footnote for St. Joan, of all things.
Now, the Bourne supremacy is not particularly sexy.
No, I don't.
There's not a lot of graphic sex scenes, which seems to be very popular in a lot of novels.
I rarely do that anyway. I mean, I figure if you want Grey's Anatomy, go buy Grey's Anatomy. I think that's kind of silly. I think so often the pandering to the masturbatory point of reading to me is kind of dull. I think it slows up a story. I'm no prude by any matter of means. I mean, if somebody wants to write pornography, God bless them, I don't care. You know, it doesn't make any difference. I have no moral point of view. I just have a storyteller's point of view. I think that you can get terribly, I think you can stop the progress of the plot too much with it.
But there is an awful lot of violence in
of course.
Guts exploding and this sort of
thing. Well, the thing is, it's the human condition. I think one of the nicest things that was ever said about me, I don't know whether it was Time or Newsweek or, God knows, not the New York Times, said that after you read a scene of violence in a Ludlum book, the last thing you ever want to do is to get into a fight. That's because I do not romanticize violence. You've never seen a character of mine who's been hurt in a violent situation. I've been there. I know what it is. The human condition can't take it. He doesn't get up and run after the Indians the next page. He doesn't do it.
You don't see your violence as gratuitous in any way?
In no way. No way. I try never to allow that. I mean, there are times when it's not a terribly lethal situation, I might allow a certain romanticism in there. In terms of technique of what a person can do physically, but if it's in terms of a person getting really wounded, really hurt, I try never to romanticize that because I don't think it ain't proper, pal. It ain't proper. It's not the way it is.
Now, one of the aspects that you mentioned, you talking about creating the aspects that are important to a thriller, you mentioned plot. But your plots are very complicated.
Oh, yeah.
It's almost, I'd like for you to comment on this, but it seems to me that your plots are complicated enough, it's almost like sitting there plotting a chess game for yourself.
I've never done it that way, but my plots are complicated because life is complicated. You know, we're rarely as we see ourselves or as even so perhaps as others see us. The things we plan often go awry, I believe, and I like to think that if you want to go from point A to point B, it's not a direct line. It never is in life. I mean, I don't know about your life or our friend's life here or anybody's life really other than my own, but it's never been simple. And I don't think we live in a simple time either.
Dialogue is very important to use, mm-hmm. even more important than the narrative.
At times, yes. Yeah. Well, that again is the theater experience. I like to think that my dialogue is fairly true because I've heard it on stage for years and off stage. Sometimes the off stage is better.
It must give you a very good feeling to know that your book has been out, I think, for 2 weeks now, and it's already at the top of the bestseller list. That's wonderful.
It leaves me shocked, astonished, very grateful, of course.
That happens over and over. It happens every year.
I'm always astonished. I really am.
Well, my last question, Robert Ludlum. This question relates to an interview that Random House sent over with you. You're quoted as saying that all writing comes from a sense of outrage.
Now, I think we have to amend that. I said that, and I was not applying it necessarily to me at all. I was applying it to just literary works in general. I said that I thought that the best writing came out of a sense of outrage. Be it dramatic, melodramatic, or even comedic, a sense of outrage. And I'm not saying that I equate myself with that. I'm saying that I think the best works I've done, the best things I've done, have come out of a sense of outrage of the abuse of power, the manipulation of people, the things that disturb me viscerally. I'm not saying it's good, better, or best, or worse, or badder. Who cares? All I meant was that I think when you think back in the history of literature, in all languages, the finest writing has come out of a sense of outrage that somebody has. And I said that years ago, and actually, I was applying it to Charles Dickens, not to myself. God knows.
Well, after you finish your publicity tour, what's going to happen? Are you going to rest up for a while?
No, I'm in the middle of something now. I I want to get back to work. that's my joy. That's my fun. You know, it keeps me out of the saloons and off the sidewalks and what have you. And so
Have a place in Connecticut?
Yeah. But we now live in Florida, Mary and I, for about 7 or 8 months out of the year. And
do you have a chance to run into Leonard Mosley down there? He lives in Fort Myers, or the Fort Myers area. Actually, he lives on Captiva Island.
Yeah, I know where Captiva is. No, I haven't run into him, no.
I don't know if you ever knew him before. He's quite an interesting man. Worth talking to. He's a long-time news correspondent.
Oh, my God, now I know who you mean. Yes, of course. No, he's in Captiva?
Yeah, he lives in Captiva.
Good Lord, I'll give him a call.
Yeah, his last book just came out. It's a biography of Walt Disney.
Yes, now you're putting it together for
me. That's right, and he wrote on Borrowed Time. And
yes, of course.
25 books.
Yeah.
Interesting thing about him was that he has something in common with you in terms of the theater. Mm. He was assistant stage manager for Minsky's 42nd Street Ballet.
He was. Well, more than you know, because I'm the guy that was responsible for bringing back Anne Corion, and this was burlesque.
As a matter of fact, he says that Anne Corion, he calls her Anne Corio, she is his best friend.
Well, I can believe that. You know, she's married to Mike Iannucci, who's a very good friend of mine. They're both very good friends. And years ago in the theater, I had a handshake with Annie and Mike, because she had called me. I had put her into a show with Alan Jenkins. That's the name you're too young to remember, but character actor from Warner Brothers. And it was so funny. I had opened the theater in Fort Lee, New Jersey, and I had an idea. I wanted to do a thing called Hole in the Head, and I was reading the script, the play, and I thought, good Lord, I remember a lady from several years before, or ago, that was just marvelous in this role. And I thought, my Lord, what is her name? I thought, Anne Corio, that's it. You know, back in the college days and this and that, when we would, you know, go and watch her and this and that. And I put in a call to the agent. And Annie, if you're listening, forgive me, but I've told you this story. I called up this clown in New York, and I said, there's a wonderful lady named Anne Corio. And he said, I think she's dead. I said, I don't think so. And finally I got the player's guide, not the player's guide, but the academy guide from the coast, and found her in Malibu. Now this had to be 20 years ago. This woman is, you know, talk about Captiva, she could buy Captiva. And she needed nothing to do with the acting. But I said, I've got a play. She said, you really want me to come back east to do a play? I said, yes, ma'am. I'm even willing to pay your plane fare. She said, my God. And she came, jewels and all, and did this play called Hole in the Head. And during this time, she got the bug to do a little bit more theater. She went to a place called Eagles near Pennsylvania, where Mike Iannucci, who had been a member of the Chicago Bears, I think, a football player, and a wonderful sense of theater, like football, a wonderful sense of theater, they got together, and she called me one night, and she said, hey, Robert, I met this fella, and he's got an idea about maybe we should do burlesque. I said, Annie, do it. And that was the forerunner of Sugar Babies and everything else. And they used to come back to my theater. By this time, we were in Paramus. And play every year on a handshake. When she could have made hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Now, she did do a tit show, didn't she, in the mid-60s. This was burlesque.
That's what I'm talking about.
Yours?
Yes. Well, it wasn't mine. It was Mike and Anne's.
Yeah.
But it was called This Was Burlesque.
Yeah.
Not only that, we brought it in New York. I know, because two of my sons wanted desperately to be on the stage group. They were.
In fact, I had made reservations at the Painters Mill Theater in Baltimore.
Yep, that's right. We played there. No, they played there, too. Yes. Yes, of course.
I made phone reservations and everything. And as I drove toward this tent, the traffic, it was St. Patrick's Day.
That's right.
The traffic was backed up so far, there was no place to park. I had reservations for I couldn't get in. The show was to start at 8 o'clock or something.
That's
like
right.
That.
Yeah.
By the time I got near the parking lot, it was about 8:40, 8:45, and I said to my wife, it's too late. We just can't get in now. And so we never did make it.
Well, I must tell you, Don, on that simple phone call 20 years ago or 18 years, whatever it is, that show has grossed over $80 million. Isn't that marvelous? Mm.
Mosley said that Anne was the most beautiful woman he'd ever seen.
Oh, absolutely. Except for my wife and your wife.
True.
But, no, and also one of the most lovely people in the world.
He also said that his other best friend was Gypsy Rose Lee, of course, who is dead. You had a lot in common with Leonard Mosley.
Yeah, I'm going to call him when we get that back. Like, yeah.
You said, hey, he must be in the 70s.
I'm close to it, it seems to me, anyway.
He's got so many stories that you, and so do you, and you and he will be talking for summer.
I won't get back to worrying. My word, what have you done to me, Don?
Robert Oldham is always great talking to you, and you're a very interesting guy, and I want you back for the next book.
Hey, listen,
hopefully it won't be on St. Patrick's Day.
No, I want to come back.
Thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you, Don.